From the Sky News Centre at 5, the mother of two young children found dead in a Spanish hotel has been charged with their murders. The 5-year-old and 11-month-old were discovered on Tuesday in Lloret de Mar. They were reportedly suffocated. Leanne Smith's been remanded in custody and taken to jail. Our crime correspondent Martin Brunt is in Blanes, where she's appeared in court.
The judge, it appears, has decided that she doesn't need any more psychiatric testing. He's satisfied that, she's of sound mind, if you want to put it that way.
A council's admitted failings after social workers didn't step in to protect a severely disabled girl who was found hanged in a bedroom. The conditions at Charlotte Avenel's home in Nottinghamshire were described as squalid and revolting. Survivors of the July 7 bombings say they're disappointed they won't be allowed to ask questions at the inquests of the 52 victims. They've been told they won't be granted the necessary special status by the coroner in October. Jackie Putnam was caught up in the Edgware Road blast.
Our questions are not going to be answered unless they're asked by someone else. Again, we've been shunted aside, and those questions need to be answered because it does involve the safety of everyone.
The Prime Minister says Britain can play a positive role in helping tackle the Eurozone financial crisis, insisting action is in everyone's interests. David Cameron has been holding talks with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin, his first visit there as PM. British Airways has reported record losses as it finalises contingency plans to deal with next week's strike. BA lost £531 million after it was hit by the recession, a harsh winter and cabin crew walkouts. Airline industry analyst John Strickland warns they could start losing business customers.
That is exactly the kind of traffic which is fleet of foot. People don't want to take the risk, and it's British Airways competitors who will be lapping up that business all around them right now.
And Kylie could be about to make a return to Neighbours. She's apparently considering reprising her role for a one-off appearance. That's the latest. I'm David Spencer.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guests to review the election fallout and some of this week's other news are Councillor for Whitchurch Park and Leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland, as well as Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Leader of the Conservative Group now, Jeff Gollop. No Martin Summers this week, who's at a wedding, but after the 6 o'clock news we have Michael Jackson. Well, not the Michael Jackson. He was painted by Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper 10 days ago or so as a drugged-up lunatic. But might he have been killed or murdered even last year for his strong views against the music industry and the US government? We hear a lucid Michael Jackson speaking about the music industry executive Tommy Mottola in 2004, around the same time as the Sun's tapes. They paint a very different picture of the singer-songwriter to that which appeared in the Sun. And managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, will be here to talk about his station's new sound, which rolled out this week, and his vision for the future. But never mind the jingles, has Radio Bristol been losing its local identity under his management? I'll be asking Tim about his sacking of some of the station's most popular presenters, such as David Lowe and John Turner. That's in the second hour. Well, on to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, really warm, averaging 21 degrees Celsius, possibly even higher during the daytime, sunny and dry all weekend. And next week, averaging 13, a bit cooler, sunny and warm on Monday, but from Tuesday, cooler again, still fairly dry with sunny spells, except Friday, excuse me, which looks wet. Next weekend, that's the 29th and 30th of May, averaging 10 degrees Celsius, even cooler, cloudy but relatively dry. So if you want to go out and see the sun, you better do it this weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news now, and the first person joining me this week is Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Leader of the Conservative Group, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, you're now Conservative Leader, is that right?
I certainly am.
Now, your previous leader was taken ill, wasn't he, a few months ago. Can you just tell us how Richard Eddy's doing?
Yes.
And is he still a councillor?
Yeah, Richard is most certainly still a councillor. I've taken over the leadership because he's still not well. But I'm glad to say in the last few weeks he's starting to make some very good progress. He's out of intensive care. He's able to communicate more easily. And he's starting to be able to move his limbs a bit. So things are looking good, and we anticipate over the next couple of months some fairly speedy recovery from him. And he'll be back at the council house fairly soon.
OK, so can you just tell us how the Conservatives go about deciding who's going to be leader and who's on various committees that they're offered? How does that work?
As far as the leader's concerned, immediately after the local elections, nominations open. Any councillor can nominate any member of the group that they want to be put forward, and we have an election. And that process was undertaken, and I was elected at the annual meeting just over a week ago.
OK, so can you tell us a bit about your background now you're the new leader? I mean, you have been on this programme before, I know, but for those that didn't hear, you know, what part sort of business are you coming from? Or, do you still work in your business, or are you dedicated to being a councillor?
I run my own business. I'm a chartered accountant advising small businesses. So I probably know what it's like at the coalface, and I'm actually talking to clients every day, hearing about their problems, what they have to deal with. So I see what it's like for people who are out there struggling to make ends meet in current economic climate.
And what's the new Liberal Conservative or the LibCon Alliance doing to help small businesses? Because I think there's many people here who, in the city, who will be really concerned about whether the big multinationals have now got too much of a lever over them, and small corner shops, for example, closing, small shops closing. Mm-hmm. So how are the Conservatives going to make life easier for small business?
Well, there's some really positive stuff in the coalition document, which hopefully will be put into practice. And for example, in terms of local councils, it's trying to set a target for 25% of procurement to be done with local small businesses, and also to give more strength to local shops in competition with the bigger shops, and a whole variety of issues that they're proposing to legislate for.
But you see, this is a real problem, isn't it? Because you've got the European legislation saying the opposite, really, that you've got to open up your tenders and things like this to all over Europe. Literally, companies from anywhere can bid. So how do does that square with this whole idea of saying that local companies will have preference?
The issue, I think, isn't so much opening it up. With modern technology, anyone can access it if they've got the technology. What we've got to do is encourage small businesses to use that technology and take the opportunity, because they're the ones best placed to both deliver the quality service and at an affordable price. So I think it's about actually making sure that small businesses realise they can put in for these contracts and these areas of work, which often they're not doing.
Right. Now, what about Mr. Clegg? Are you happy with him? Is he being a good boy?
Oh, it's far too early to say that. But an interesting quote on one of the television stations recently was that in the course of the election campaign, the leaders were looking at their differences. Since the election, they've been looking at the things they've got in common. And I think that's the important thing, is to identify the strengths of the two parties' policies and keep working on them together.
So does that mean that anything where there's a difference, like, for example, there's a difference over Trident, there's a difference over the possible nuclear power stations here in the Bristol Channel, that they're just simply put on hold?
But they won't be put on hold. They, as I understand it, they're going to try and develop common policy. But there will be the option for Lib Dem MPs to vote against. Fortunately, there is no such local coalition, so I'm still in a position to say exactly what my party feels.
Okay. We have the voting system is one of the big things that's been being talked about in this election. Are you happy about proportional representation yourself as a Conservative?
I'm not entirely happy about proportional representation, although very strangely, if we had proportional representation in Bristol, the makeup of the council would be very different and Conservatives would have more councillors. Personally, I still believe the first-past-the-post system in general gives a clear mandate. And the thing that concerns me about alternative voting systems is exactly that. There are so many different alternatives and each one of them produces a different result, and no one can clearly say which one's the right one.
Well, with your boss, David Cameron, now running things, I mean, what about this? I mean, we were told there was going to be some kind of new politics. What we've got, though, is David Cameron, George Osborne, part of this Bullingdon Club in Oxford, all lads that were privileged, really, went to Eton, this kind of thing. So, really, nothing's changed, has it?
I think that it's difficult to judge what people may have done when they were in their late teens. I suspect you might have done the odd thing that you might not wish to justify now. And so I think, to be honest, it's actually about the best people for the job. And I think that the class warfare argument is history, to be honest. It's actually about people who can manage the country and deal with the, in particular, with the current economic crisis.
Yeah, but 90% of the people just simply don't have access to that level of education. These are privileged people, aren't they?
And that's the reason why we have to make sure that those opportunities are made available to everybody rather than kept for a small minority.
Well, let's see how that goes, Jeff. I'd also like to welcome councillor for Whitchurch Park and leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Hi, Helen.
Hello, Tony.
Now, first of all, the election, how did it go for you? Where were you?
Well, I was in Whitchurch Park because of the, you know, bizarre system that we have in Bristol of going by thirds.
Yep.
All of the wards in Bristol South were up for the local elections as well, but we were working very hard, obviously, as part of the Bristol South constituency for the parliamentary result as well.
Okay. Now, the Labour leadership, which everyone's talking about at the moment, who's going to take over from Gordon Brown, yesterday and the day before, we were even hearing about the possibility of gerrymandering, not enough time for MPs to actually go back and ask their constituency parties who they should be voting for in this leadership election.
Well, I don't think that's the case. And actually, I'm pleased that the National Executive has said that we, you know, the outcome of the vote won't be known until our conference, which is right at the end of September. So I think that, you know, there's plenty of time for candidates to come, talk to party members, party activists. Of course, there are quite a few disillusioned Liberal Democrats who are joining the Labour Party now, and we want to hear from them as well. And I think there's plenty of time to have the debate about what sort of a Labour Party do we want moving into the, you know, over the next period, rather than just the best person for the job on a quick, you know, who does the media think looks best.
So what sort of Labour Party do you want, Helen?
What I want is a reforming Labour Party, a very progressive Labour Party. Clearly, with the Liberal Democrats going in with the Conservatives, Labour becomes the only progressive main party in the country. And we need to show people what that means and what difference that makes. And I think because of the, you know, the kind of hiatus around the election, that there's been some people have lost some of the issues that actually... you know, the Labour vote recovered in the last couple of days of the election, and what it is that Labour did that transformed this country. You look around you, you know, where we are now just didn't exist 13 years ago. New schools, new hospitals, new investment in public services. We want to remind people that that's what Labour stands for.
So who will you be voting for?
Well, I don't know yet.
Are you a Miliband fan? Because this is the sort of new Labour faction, isn't it? And it does seem that most of the candidates have come from that faction. I mean, the obvious person to stand would have been Harriet Harman, who's the deputy leader.
Yeah, I think that one of the things about the political life actually is that it is very sudden death, isn't it? You know, one day you're there as Prime Minister, the next day you're gone. And one of the things that I've been reflecting on quite a bit over the last fortnight, the fact that Harriet very soon said she wasn't going to stand, Alan Johnson said he wasn't going to stand, you suddenly realise, you know, that it's almost a generational thing, and the Labour Party, quite rightly, is looking to the next generation, not the generation, if you like, that has seen us through the last 13 years. So, you know, those people have cancelled themselves out of the race. We'll see how many more candidates we've got. Obviously, there are quite a number now coming out of the woodwork. And hopefully they'll be given the space to have a proper debate, not in the way that some of the media have been doing, you know, getting psychologists in to talk about sibling rivalry with the Milibands rather than what the issues are.
Okay, so what about the voting system, though? Because one of the things that's come out during this election, maybe more than previous times, is the lack of proportionality between the actual votes cast around the country and the number of MPs for each party which actually turn up in Westminster. What are your thoughts about the voting system?
Well, I'm like Jeff, really. I need to be convinced that the first-past-the-post system is not giving us the results that we want.
Well, listen, you two would say that, wouldn't you? Because it's kept Conservative and Labour governments over the years in power, where actually, if the right number of MPs to the number of people or the number of votes cast were there, we'd have had lots more coalitions over the last 40, 50 years.
We would have done. And you know, what we saw in Britain is nothing new to people in European countries and other countries where they do have more proportional systems. But I do think that we need to, you know, take a deep breath and really have a good look, because although we came out with a, you know, balanced, as some people would call it, hung parliament this time, was that what people were really voting for? The idea that people voted for a hung parliament, that was the result, but I don't think they positively voted for that. And I just think that we need to have a good look, and that we don't just jump in with something that looks better than what we've got now but doesn't necessarily do it for us. I mean, one of the things that worries me is, you know, and it's a figure that's been widely used, is that even though the BNP, for example, lost all of its council seats on Barking and Dagenham, you would still nevertheless potentially have had up to 10 BNP MPs. Well, if we're working out what kind of coalition we want, I don't want those extremist parties to be part of it.
Well, many people would say the only reason that these extremist parties get the votes is because the major parties just simply don't deal with immigration, the issue of immigration.
Except that I think if you have a look at what actually happened, the BNP lost, I think, all of its council seats around the country. Nick Griffin, there was all this talk he was going to take Margaret Hodges' seat. He didn't. He was nowhere near, actually. And I think when people are really presented, as they were, partly because of the device of the leaders' debates, people were much more clear about what the real issues were. And yes, they may have gone back to the three main parties, but you can see that some of the other parties, the Greens, BNP, were squeezed. And, you know, we can't devise a proportional system which is nice to those parties we kind of like the Greens, you know, warm and fuzzy, and not nice equally to the other extremes. So I just think let's have a real debate about what kind of a proportional system we want. The problem is partly that the cat is out of the bag, because we've already got proportional systems in Scotland and Wales and for the London Assembly, a London mayor. But, you know, let's have a real good look at it before we decide.
Now, it's back to you, Jeff, for a little while. I mean, what were your thoughts about the whole way that the TV leadership debates played out? Do you think that that played much of a role in the election, and were you pleased with them?
Well, positive about the fact that it produced much more interest in the election campaign, and I think that was good. I think that there is a danger now, and it's interesting your discussions with Radio Bristol later about the whole media involvement of if you like, dumbing down. And it became very much an X Factor come Britain's Got Talent judgment. And I don't think that does a proper service to the electoral process, because it isn't, and it should never be, purely a presidential campaign. It's actually about the teams behind the leaders as well, and those that are going to make up their front benches. And so the danger, I think, of that debate process is that it concentrates on three people, each leading their own party. And that makes it much simpler than it actually is. So I don't think we can change it. It's going to be there for the future, but I would love to see future programmes and series developing the teams behind the people that are being proposed.
There was a little bit stilted, the audience, weren't they, sort of sitting there twiddling their thumbs, and they were instructed that they weren't allowed to say or clap or boo or anything, and it did seem rather stilted like that. Did you find that the issues that the media were bringing to people's attention, the newspapers, etc., during the election campaign, were in any way kind of related to what you were hearing on the doorsteps? I'll ask you first, Jeff.
No. Very little, actually. I mean, we were finding a few local and a few major national issues when we were out talking to people, but the general comments we were getting didn't tie up with anything that the papers were flagging up as headlines. And that worries me as well, because I think it's a real sign that, that the press were trying to dictate the subjects in the campaign, and we didn't find that electors, for the most part, really wanted to go along with that.
OK, so what were people coming up with on the doorsteps that wasn't really being covered by the press? Was it things like dog dirt and litter, that sort of thing,
oh,
or what?
No, no, no. There were various serious concerns about the financial situation.
See, I'm doing it again, aren't I? I'm being the media, coming up with things
exactly
that actually aren't people's real concerns.
In fact, one of our concerns, and I suspect Helen was the same, that people were not substantially concerned about local issues. And that's one of the disadvantages of having local elections on the same day as the general election, is that you don't give a full airing to the local issues. But the main concerns we were coming across were finance, were concerns about education, and concerns about transport, both local and national. And those are the issues we were finding people were really getting very worked up about and very worried about. And it wasn't necessarily the stories that the press were trying to lead with.
Or the things that got dealt with really in any great depth by the leadership debates. Anyway, what about you, Helen? What was your feeling about those debates?
Well, again, it's a bit like the I agree with Nick comments.
Okay,
isn't it? Yeah. I agree with Jeff that one of the things that happened, I think, was that you know, the three leaders were the main event. I also agree with what you said about how stilted the audience, you know, non-participation was. And it reminded me a little bit about when they first started televising Parliament, when, do you remember that, you know, it was only going to be on the person who was speaking and you wouldn't see her. And obviously there are those kind of rules when something's new, but hopefully it'll get a bit more, easy.
Let's hope so.
At future times. But I heard one story, for example, where somebody had gone back after going to the polling station and picking up their ballot paper, had gone back to the presiding officer to tell them that the person that they wanted to vote for wasn't on the ballot paper, and the presiding officer said, well, who is that, you know, hoping to be able to help with any confusion, and the person said, well, it's Gordon Brown. And so I think that that's quite indicative, really, that people thought it was a beauty contest between the three leaders. And there was this sense that kind of nothing mattered between the Thursdays, wasn't there? It went quiet, and we were analysing the previous one and working out what was going to happen at the next one, and rather than some of the other major issues and some of the major players, whether that would be, you know, people in the existing great offices of state, if you like, Home Secretary, debating with their shadows and so on. Some of that got missed. It was all about how is Nick Clegg going to perform after his wonderful performance in the first one. And so whilst I think it's good and it's the modern thing to do, clearly, it did mean that there was a polarisation around the performance of the leaders.
And what about on the doorsteps, though? Did you find that the media was bringing up issues in the election campaign and there was something kind of separate happening on the doorsteps?
Yeah, a bit. I think it was a bit, you know, both one and the other. First of all, there was a lot higher awareness that there was an election happening. I mean, I'm sure that Jeff would agree that sometimes when it's the local elections, you knock on the door and tell people, you know, there's the local elections are in 3 weeks' time. It's the first they've heard of it. You know, they just don't know that it's happening. That you didn't meet anybody at all who didn't.
No, well, that's because
that
it's a general election, isn't it? Yeah.
On. Yeah. Well, I think, but also because of the media coverage. But I think that some of the issues were around, they were around people wanting to know that politicians were on their side, whatever the issue was, whether that was about, you know, the plans in Bristol to start weighing the bins, which was something that was certainly a big issue in our area, people very worried about that and opposed to it, right through to some of the bigger national issues about the national debt, whether there was going to continue to be funding for public services and so on.
Well, yeah, that's a big one, isn't it? Because do the politicians really control that? I mean, surely it's they've bought up all these banks. You know, we've had public money spent on buying these banks, but still the banks really seem to be almost dictating terms. And how much power, maybe you can answer this, Jeff, as you're more of a finance type, does the government have really to do something about this impending possible double dip recession?
Well, I have to say I don't understand why the government did not exercise more control over the banks. And at the moment, the amount of lending the banks are doing is still only a token. They're doing it so that they can say to the government that they're doing it, but they're not actually openly making lending available. My experience of clients trying to borrow money at the moment is that they've got to jump through hoops and crawl through tunnels and do the assault course before they'll end up being granted something.
So is George Osborne going to be able to do, do you think, up in Westminster what Alistair Darling couldn't, and actually twist the arms of the banks to release a little bit of funds to keep our companies going?
I would hope that he will be able to.
Fingers crossed.
But you know, the fact is, the people managing the banks are the same people who managed them into the crisis. And that is something that is very difficult for government to actually take control of, because they're the ones who think they know how to run those businesses.
Okay, now let's go and have a look at some of this week's stories. We've just about talked, I think, to death about the election there. Let's just have a look at some of there. Actually, no, I say that, but there was quite a lot of voting anomalies, weren't there, in this election, particularly some locally. At least, I think everybody that wanted to vote and was at the polling station by 10 o'clock did vote in Bristol, as far as I know. But there were all sorts of problems with ballot papers and problems with some of the counts. I don't know if either of you were at any of the counts where there were problems. Helen, what did you see?
Well, I don't think actually, unfortunately, that it's true that everybody in Bristol who wanted to vote and had registered got the opportunity. Certainly I've been made aware of people who didn't get their postal ballot forms. And I think that actually the election night, certainly in Bristol South, I was at the count, which wasn't declared until 5:45 in the morning, when normally in the past it's been at about 1:30, 2 o'clock. It was an absolute shambles, and you really do have to ask about, you know, how much thought had gone into. It's a general election, there are more ballot papers, the ballot papers are bigger because there are more candidates. All those sorts of things are pretty straightforward, actually, if you're planning things. Like the you know, the postal ballots, 2,500 going astray between, well, in this area here, that should have gone for Bristol West, and the new Bristol West covers this area, but went to Bristol East. I mean, if there's anything that you would have done, if you'd known there's a big election coming up, you would have sampled some of those papers, made sure that the right ballot papers were going to the right people. So It was very basic things at the Bristol South count, like the tables weren't big enough. That people, although the City Council obviously employs people to count, for hours at a time, the people were sitting at their tables with no ballot papers being put in front of them. And it was an utter shambles, to be honest. And then the next day, on the Friday, when we had the local elections count, and some of us haven't got to bed till probably about 6:30 because of the general, you know, 6:30 in the morning, general election count, had to be back at the council house at 9 o'clock. The very first local election count that they did, they discovered some misplaced ballot papers, so all of the declarations had to be held up. And again, it was a complete shambles. And I'm really glad to see that Jan Ormond-Droyd, the chief executive of the council, has asked for people to write in with their experience. I know that Liberty, on their website, there's a form and you can fill that in, and I hope that people will do it so the full extent of how badly it went wrong can be revealed. Because, you know, who knows, we might be in another general election situation quite soon, and let's hope it will go better than this one did.
Well, so if anyone out there did experience problems with the election, what should they do?
My understanding is that there's a form on the City Council's website, so if you go onto the website, you'll be able to search and find that there. People can write to their own councillors, write direct to Jan Ormond-Droyd. There's a meeting for candidates and agents to talk about what their experience, I think there's two actually, meetings next week, so people can find out. I'm sorry, I haven't got the details with me, but okay, they can find out about those meetings. Or similarly, if they want it to go into this national survey, the organisation Liberty has something on their website.
What about you, Jeff? What are your thoughts about the way the election was conducted? Never mind the politics of it.
Yeah, very similar. I can't be certain that some people didn't miss out on voting, because certainly there were a number of polling stations where the queues were quite high at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and some people went away, came back later when there were queues, and we don't know whether they got in to vote or not. So I suppose one of the things one could ask now is if there is anybody out there who didn't get to in to vote, please would they make sure they register that fact? Because it's important that people can vote exactly when they want to vote. Like Helen, I was at the Bristol North West count and staggered. I won't say how many general election counts I've been to, but they all concluded far earlier than this one. And there weren't more ballots to count this time round than there were at some of the...
So why did it take so long?
I wish I knew. In North West as well, there were people sat with nothing to do. The legislation has actually changed so that they can start counting sooner in the process than used to be the case, but that wasn't taken advantage of, as I understand it, at any of the Bristol counts, and a great deal of time was lost. If I give you one example of the sort of problem, 10 days before general election day, they discovered that the venue for the Bristol North West count wasn't big enough, so it actually had to be moved to the Bristol City Stadium, which actually meant that the first ballot papers didn't arrive at the count until about 45 minutes after the polls had closed, whereas in past years they arrived 5 minutes after the polls closed. So one immediately had a reason why the process was delayed, and I think that's just symptomatic that there was something wrong with making sure that the process worked efficiently and smoothly. One of the critical things is that all people taking part believe it's a transparent and fair process. And if things start going wrong and bundles of ballot papers disappear, the fact is it leaves a very strong element of doubt in the minds of those taking part. But again, the Chief Executive, Jan Almond-Royd, has set this inquiry in hand. She reacted extremely promptly to the problems and is trying to ensure that it's resolved. So any criticism one makes of the process, one has also got to say, yes, but action is being taken to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
OK, well, we'll see if we can find out when those meetings are before the end of the programme.
I can tell you.
Yes. Oh, you can. Fantastic, Jeff. Thank you.
Monday evening at 6 o'clock.
This is all at the council house.
The council house.
Yeah.
And the next one is on Friday, I believe it's the 4th of June, and I believe that one is 2 till 4.
Okay. Well, we're going to have a little bit of music now. We'll be back in a minute to talk to Helen Holland and Jeff Gollop about some of the other news this week.
La palma, yo soy un hombre sincero. The words mean I am a truthful man from the land of the palm trees. And before dying, I want to share these poems of my soul. My poems are soft green. My poems are also flaming crimson. My poems are like a wounded fawn seeking refuge in the forest. The last verse says, con los pobres de la tierra.
With the poor people of this earth I want to share my fate. The streams of the mountains please me more than the sea.
Conocemos que el
Sandpipers there with Guantanamera. And now I'm joined in the studio by Jeff Gollop, who's the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, and Helen Holland, who's the leader of the Labour group. And we're going to have a look at some of this week's news stories now, starting with the announcement yesterday that we may be seeing Royal Mail privatisation set for delivery next week. Now, Jeff, is this something you're pleased to see?
Yeah, very positive. And of course, just to show we all have an open mind, because we're following on from Labour Party policy from the previous government. So I presume there'll be unanimous support in the House of Commons for this particular move.
Now, last time it was discovered that actually there wasn't anybody who seemed to want to put up the money to actually buy Royal Mail, because in other countries in Europe it had been found that it was actually not very profitable. I mean, what's happened is a lot of the most profitable parts of Royal Mail have now already been privatised, so there's nobody, none of the companies, at least last year, was prepared to put up the money to take over something which was the less profitable arm of the post office. So you're confident that there's going to be some money around this time?
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, as a user, I want to see an improvement in the service and a level of competition that means I can get value for money in using the postal service.
But one of the things the union is saying, that it may mean that there is an end to a delivery every day, that it may be a delivery every other day, and that kind of thing.
I think it's too early to tell what the outcome is going to be, but it does seem to me that if with the improved and increased level of technology, one is going to need to invest significant sums of money, and if we can find people who are prepared to invest that money rather than being the taxpayer, that seems to me to be all well and good, because the taxpayer's money is going to be needed to maintain services and ensure that public sector borrowing is kept under control.
Now, the post offices themselves are separate to the Royal Mail, and it's actually the Royal Mail that they're talking about privatising now, not the post offices. What are your thoughts about this story, Helen?
Well, I was relieved to see that there wasn't going to be an attack on the post offices, because I think the view of the post office network has changed over the last couple of years, and more effort has been made, particularly in communities where the post office really is the hub of a community, to put other services there to make sure that they're viable. But I think that, you know, you've put your finger on it really with the Royal Mail, that the Labour government was going to have had enough problems with that proposal, with our own MPs, the trade unions against it, and the point's also been made, hasn't it, that actually the kind of money-making bit of the Royal Mail has already disappeared, and so is what's there, is that going to be something that there's going to be commercial interest in, let alone the problem that we've already identified with the banks being very reluctant to lend money. So it's one, I think, to watch, but you can guarantee that obviously the Royal Mail trade unions are going to be very upset about it.
But why did the Labour Party privatise the best bits of the Royal Mail in the first place?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm sure if I was an MP I would have the answer, but personally, you know, you can't, these part privatisations never work, because you are left with a part of an organisation which can't be viable and stand alone.
Seems a bit of a con, Jeff, because it's like, if the Royal Mail had been just left alone to be able to carry on, do its own job as a monopoly, there would be no need to do this, would there?
Well, I think it's questionable whether there'd be a need to do it. The demand is changing. the requirements are changing, and Royal Mail as a service centre wasn't able to develop what its customers needed, and therefore there was a need to deregulate and allow others to come in and provide those services. I think that's a classic sign of competition actually helping to improve what is available for customers, and hopefully it can now move forward and actually benefit those of us with our own individual home deliveries.
The problem is, you know, what we saw was that they picked off the best bits, picked off the lucrative bits. Exactly the same if you think about, you know, what's laughingly called public transport. It's not public at all. You know, the bits that make money are desirable. The bits that aren't are left for the public sector to pick up, in the same way, as I say, that the City Council endlessly has to pick up bus routes that First Group decide are non-profit making. It doesn't work in getting a better service overall if what you lose is so much of what people really rely on. And yes, I'm sure that an element of competition has stirred things up, but have we lost more than we've gained?
Well, we'll see next week. We find out exactly what, whether or not the government does decide it wants to privatise Royal Mail. And this is something which I think is going to be one of the main things in the Queen's speech next week. Now, next story. Bristol Airport expansion plans are recommended for approval. This is from the website bristol247.com a few days ago. North Somerset Council officers are recommending approval for Bristol Airport's £150 million expansion in advance of a key meeting to decide the plans on Monday. Now, but what do you, both of you thoughts? I know this is just outside our area, isn't it? But what about Bristol Airport? Should we be expanding it?
Well, personally, I was pleased to see that the North Somerset officers were recommending approval of the expansion at the airport, because I think that, you know, this is very different from the Heathrow additional runway. There's no additional runway capacity talked about, but I think that what the expansion would do would mean that the growth that is happening anyway at Bristol Airport would be accommodated better, so they'll actually be able to deal with parking better. They'll be able to be the planning conditions, as I understand it, that the North Somerset officers are putting on the expansion will mean that there will be a huge amount invested in improvements in surface transport to the airport and so on. And the City Council, although, as you say, the airport itself is outside the City Council's area, we did support a motion some months back now which recognised that, you know, a major conurbation like the Greater Bristol area does need a modern airport to be able to serve it. And we need to have an airport which actually serves business use as well as leisure and holiday use. It does to a certain extent, but I think what the airport wants to see is that balance slightly change. And obviously with the decision of the incoming government not to allow the runway, the additional runway at Heathrow, the regional airports, I understand the Bristols, the Birminghams, Stansteads and so on, there will be more pressure on them.
Jeff, this is interesting, isn't it? Because on the one hand, the Conservative government is saying we want to stop the expansion of Heathrow, and what it's really doing is it's simply just farming, isn't it, out those aircraft to the regional airports, and hence we're having expansion here in Bristol.
Which I think what we've got to look at is what is the demand for, and the demand from people in the Greater Bristol area is to have access to air travel, and we've got to get the balance right, because clearly there is an ecological issue here, and we've got to make sure that any development is done in such a way that it minimises the impact on the environment. But we also have to recognise that Bristol can't operate in a vacuum. It needs international trade, it needs people visiting it for the tourist trade, it needs to interact with other cities both in the UK and in Europe, and we can't ignore the need for growth. And so I certainly welcome this intended approval, because it seems to me that increased prosperity for Bristol means increased prosperity for everybody in Bristol. It will help to secure jobs, and that at the end of the day is probably the most important thing.
But it's going to be more flights, isn't it? It's going to mean more flights over people's heads and in people's gardens. You know, this is the downside. I mean, isn't that something that worries you?
It worries me to the extent that I say we have to be careful, but we also recognise that the nature of aircraft and their pollution and their noise is diminishing. But what we also have to recognise is if people can be travelling from Bristol rather than driving to an airport 100 miles away and flying from there, then actually that's got to be better than would otherwise be the case. So I think it's a question of looking at what is the best scenario for the circumstances, and developing Bristol certainly seems to me to be doing that.
I noticed that part of the development is a car park, and that's one of the things I think is a real problem down at Bristol Airport, is just this ridiculously high parking fees and also rather a messy car park. So anyway, hopefully that will be sorted out with this new permission, if it happens, which is, I think that's something that's going to be decided next week. Okay, so scientists create artificial life in a laboratory. This is a big story yesterday and a bit of a weird one really. Synthetic DNA put into cells, and now apparently we've got these kind of artificial bacteria multiplying away. Let's start with you, Helen. What are your thoughts about this bizarre concept? Artificial life has been created in the laboratory. Where will this end?
Well, where will it end? And you know, I was watching this on the news last night and worrying slightly about it. But then on the other hand, you can't you know, you can't decide which science not to have. And people are developing, obviously, the you know, being able to create artificial DNA. And I thought actually that was a very interesting part about the story, about the extraordinary work that had gone into that. But then it's the applications, isn't it, that this is put to, if it's going to deal with some, you know, despite medical advances, there are still some terrible diseases that afflict mankind. And are we going to be able to use this for good uses? You know, if it's for the sort of, you know, artificial intelligence and a kind of, you know, 22nd century scenario, then it's a bit more concerning. But you have to applaud actually the scientists who, you know, put their effort, their life's work into working on these things. Then it's all about application, and it's about regulating those applications and being able to control it.
Well, just to make it clear, others, however, according to this Times article from yesterday, are unconvinced. Ben Davis, who works on synthetic biology at the University of Oxford, said, "I think we're quite a long way from artificial life." Anyway, Jeff, what are your thoughts about the ethics around this issue?
Well, I'm no scientist, so I have to say I struggle to even understand the concepts here. But if you look back, when history was made with the first test tube baby, there were all manner of concerns and issues raised by scientists then. When there was various genetic modifications, there have been concerns raised. At each stage, however, if those developments are used to actually improve the lot of people in general by one means or another, then I don't think we're in a position to condemn it. But what I would want to know is that it is very seriously regulated, not just nationally, but worldwide, because one never knows how such developments can be used to harm the human race as well as to benefit it.
We could end up with synthetic politicians.
Well, now, there's an interesting thought indeed.
Okay, thanks on that one. Now we're moving on to another story which is very close to heart here, which is the Hinkley Power Station just down the road, just, I think, upwind from us, in fact. The French energy giant is saying, "We will go it alone on Hinkley C." This is from the Somerset Guardian the other day. The French energy giant, bidding to build a replacement nuclear power plant in Somerset, says the government's pledge not to subsidise new stations won't slow it down. Now, we heard last week from Friends of the Earth, who were in on this programme, that there's a new organisation which was set up by the Labour government, which is going to fast-track the planning permission for this. So, Jeff, what are your thoughts about what's going to happen down at Hinkley C and whether it should require government subsidy?
Well, I certainly don't believe it should require government subsidy. I have to say, this is an area, again, not claiming to be a scientist, where I don't understand the issues enough to be certain, and I would certainly want to know that before it progresses, government and the energy provider had ensured that that maximum public safety was taken into consideration. So that would seem to me to be the most fundamental issue. Certainly, I don't believe the government should be subsidising power. But what I'd also want to know, that the government wasn't going to be subsidising the clean-up afterwards, however many years down the line. Because that has been the current problem with the first generation of nuclear power stations, that no one had considered what the costs were going to be of decommissioning them. So actually it needs to be a whole life project that actually looks at whether it is affordable throughout, not a question of whether it provides cheap power to start with and we'll worry about cleaning up later. And that's the bit that I want some real assurance on.
So maybe the banks are lending to the French energy giant, but not to our small businesses. But anyway, we've got this thing here called the Infrastructure Planning Commission, which Labour Party set up, which is a way of fast-tracking the planning permission. Are the Conservatives, do you know, going to do anything about that? Because normally there's a public inquiry held into these things, and there's much more input from the local population. This is a way of getting these planning permissions quicker and easier without consulting local people so much.
My understanding of the coalition document is that it says that it wishes to replace the Infrastructure Planning Commission with something that is more democratically accountable. I don't know what the details are,
okay.
But I would certainly hope to see that it was actually people who were accountable rather than officials who were not.
So the French energy giant EDF, Helen, is saying that it's going to build this whether we like it or not, or whether we subsidise it or not, should I say?
Well, I mean, there are two things I'd like to say here. One of them is about the Infrastructure Planning Commission, or its successor. Whilst my understanding about what the previous government wanted to do was to make sure that there were some issues that are, you know, big infrastructure for the country, do need a more coordinated way of approving them. The high-speed rail, for example, that's being talked about. You know, it's not really feasible to think of that being given permission in chunks as it goes up through the country, through the various counties that it goes through, although obviously you do want to hear from people. So having a way of being able to make decisions at a national level about some of the important infrastructure, I thought was the right thing, so long as people did know how they could make their representations. It was absolutely transparent where representations had made a difference in the decisions that were come to. I mean, the other interesting thing, of course, is that some of the other European countries, for example, which have a much greener record than us, are far more reliant on nuclear power than this country currently is. And there's this imbalance between the speed at which we can go to greener alternatives, wind and wave energy and all the rest of it, which all of us want to see, and the Southwest is a focus of that, and there's potential for many what they call green collar jobs out of that work. And then what we're being faced with is, in a few years' time, if the calls for power, that we all use more and more power at home for everything, that with a plug on, as they say, that we're going to run out of energy. So obviously we have to have a really hard look at that. The Labour government had previously invested in a lot of green technologies, but it's whether or not that will fill the gap. I wouldn't want to see nuclear going ahead without people being able to assess the case, not just make a commercial decision with foreign investors paying for it without, as Jeff said, understanding the implications down the line.
Well, the way EDF are spinning it, this is this French energy company, is our plans for 20 billion plus investment, I'm not quite sure where they get this 20 billion from, in low carbon energy can help boost the UK's economic activity and create tens of thousands of jobs. But I'm just going to ask you both about what you think about this whole thing of low carbon energy. Is that really important, Jeff?
Low carbon energy, yes, is important. It's about how we minimise pollution. But the fact is that one also has to know, as I said earlier, what the implications are. And the decommissioning of a nuclear plant has a very significant pollution impact on the local community, and therefore one needs to understand those issues before you can make that judgment and find a way of measuring that as well.
Well, you might find that EDF come in quite happy to make lots of money selling their electricity, but when it comes to clearing up afterwards, they may not be around.
We probably won't be either, so hopefully it's a long way down the line, but it's someone else's problem, and that needs to be clear at the start, rather than them planning to say, oh, well, the technology we'll develop to deal with it later. We need to know now what that process will be, what it will cost, and is it built into that process, or are they expecting the government to fund it?
OK, Bristol residents are in a legal battle over the new £92 million football stadium. And this is nearly 200 residents who have begun a legal fight which could scupper plans for the new football stadium at Ashton Vale. They're applying for town green status to protect the 42-acre site from new development and therefore end a dream for thousands of football fans to watch Bristol City play in the new 30,000-seater stadium. So, Helen, what are your thoughts on this story? There's already been a few setbacks. It's now got its planning permission, the stadium, out on this Greenfield site. But now we hear that the local people are put in a legal challenge and a town green to stop the stadium.
Well, the town green, so-called town green legislation, I think is one of those pieces of legislation that was put in without the full consequences being thought of. And whilst I completely accept the right of the people who are very close to where the new stadium is going to be to object and to use every mechanism that they can, the idea that the land where the stadium is proposed to be built was ever a town green, yes, people walk their dogs over it, but that land was a tip largely before the proposals to build the stadium came along. So yes, the inquiry needs to run its course and the inspector needs to make a decision about the representations that have been made, but at the same time, again, it's one of those issues about the bigger picture against the very local detriment. And I think personally that Bristol, if we see ourselves on the European stage, we want to be go-ahead city, then we have to have sports facilities that are modern, that are accessible, that do the job which the current city ground, or if I can say so, the Memorial Stadium, don't actually do.
Don't you think that Bristol City are sort of guilt-tripping people here and saying, well, look, we want permission to build on a greenfield site here, which is very cheap land to buy, and then we're going to sell the old plot to a supermarket, and actually this is just simply a money-making deal, and what they're doing is they're actually getting to build on fields which no one else would normally be able to do. The other big issue, of course, with this is it means that people will have to actually travel out of the city in order to go to the football matches rather than just be able to walk as they used to do.
Well, I mean, I live very close to the city ground as is, and the new site is about half a mile further on. So, I'm aware on a Saturday afternoon when lots of people try and park outside my house that they'll probably still carry on doing it. But then thousands of people who already walk or use public transport to get to the stadium will also carry on doing it. And the access into the new stadium that's proposed is a much more logical and visible one. But I don't think that necessarily the football club, I mean, you can understand why they're pressing their case very hard, but I don't think they're trying to guilt trip people, because after all they also had permission to redevelop the football club on the existing Ashton Gate site, but then their vision became much bigger, much greater, and I think that a kind of refurbished Ashton Gate would not do what a brand new stadium would do.
Jeff, for the Conservatives, let's have your thoughts on this one. Are you pleased to see that 200 local people are now putting up a legal challenge to the stadium?
Well, they're using the legal system that allows them to do that, and they have that right to do that. But I do think we need to be very careful in terms of the overall planning and other legislation, that if in fact there are so many routes that different people can use to object to developments, one will find that developers will not want to go ahead. And the fact is that I, as a Bristolian, would love to see a Premiership football club with a Premiership football ground in Bristol. And the fact is, we're a long way from both at the moment. At least if we've got the stadium, we have got the possibility that we can then bring the level of football to go with it. So I think one has to have a vision, and I think it's a great pity that if too many campaigns go on to stop this happening, we will end up with a football club not investing, and we need that.
OK, Jeff, thanks very much. This week's guests then, that's the councillor for Whitchurch Park and leader for the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, that's Helen Holland, who's discussing some of this week's news and the elections with the councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, leader for the council's Conservative group, Jeff Gollop. And just to remind you of the dates for the election, anyone that had problems with the these recent elections that we had, there's a meeting this coming Monday, the 24th of May, between 6 and 8pm at the Council House. And there's another meeting for anyone that can't make that on Friday, the 4th of June. We think, fingers crossed, that it's between 2 and 4 on that Friday, the 4th of June. Coming up in a minute, we're going to have BBC Radio Bristol's Tim Pemberton, and we'll hear from Michael Jackson. So join us after the news.
You are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.